Yes, I'm delighted to be welcoming social psychologist Jonathan Haidt onto the program. I read an essay of his called When and Why Nationalism Beats Globalism and How Moral Psychology Can Help Explain and Reduce the Tensions Between the Two. And I thought, and was advised to me, it was one of the best explanations around about all of these divisions that seem to be happening in Western society. Jonathan says the question for Western nations may be this: how do we reap the gains of global cooperation in trade, culture, education, human rights and environmental protection, while respecting, rather than diluting or crushing, the world's many local, national and other parochial identities, each with its own traditions and moral order? In what kind of world can globalists and nationalists live together? Jonathan is a professor at the New York University Stern School of Business. Demand for his time is currently at its peak. He's hoping that when the US returns to its normal levels of political dysfunction, he says on his automated response, he'll have more time. Jonathan, thank you so much for making the time to talk to Saturday Extra.
Oh, my pleasure.
When do you think it will return to its normal levels of political dysfunction?
But not in my lifetime.
Oh, no. Do you mean that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, dear.
I do.
Okay, well, we'll just leave that aside for the moment because I want to get to these very interesting conclusions you draw. Your premise is that using moral psychology to explain these seismic shifts that are so befuddling a lot of us, I think, is vital. What's your working definition then of moral psychology?
Moral psychology is the study of this human tendency we have to judge each other, believe that other people are bad and others are good. It's just a deep part of our nature, and that's what I've been studying since graduate school in the 1980s. And gradually, I used to study how nations differed. I did my early work in Brazil and India, but as the American culture war got really intense in the 1990s, I began to notice that left and right were like different cultures, like different nations with their own, not just their own morals, but their own U.S. history, their own climate science, and so that's what I've been studying, and it's just been getting worse and worse, not just in America, but in many other countries too.
Yes, well, we had David Goodhart, who's a British thinker, on the program last week discussing his Somewheres and Everywheres.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So what's your definition of the two groups to help us almost sort of distill it in our minds?
Yeah, so you have to see that there's always a kind of a left-right divide. I mean, you can see this even in ancient China, in ancient Rome. There are some people who just are drawn to change and variety, and they want to know what's going on all around the world. And then there are other people who want more stability, and they worry when there's too much change. And they tend to be on time for appointments, and their apartments are actually cleaner and more organized, the research shows. So there is a psychological basis to the left-right divide. And in the early 20th century, that mostly showed up over economic arrangements like, you know, capital, you know, the labor versus capital. But what's happening now around the Western world is that the old left-right battles are kind of reorienting. They're not going away, but they're kind of shifting 20 degrees, let's say, so that issues of borders and national identity have really come into focus in a lot of places. And so the terms that I use, and there are others who use these, Michael Lind and many others, actually Marine Le Pen uses these terms practically, are globalists and nationalists. And if you just keep your eye on those two concepts, those two identities, you can understand a lot of what's happening around the world.
Well, what's interesting in terms of your approach is that you say generally when people have started to come to terms with this, they look at the nationalists because everyone's worried about nationalism because they think it sort of was prefigured World War II, et cetera, et cetera. You've mm-hmm. decided to look at the globalists and how
That's
their
right.
changing values may in fact drive an illiberal tendency among the nationalists.
That's right. And there are two reasons for focusing on the globalists. The first is that when I think you said everybody looks at, well, everybody just means people like us. Everybody is the analyst class, and they're located in the capital cities and university towns, and they vote for the left-leaning parties. So everyone who's doing these analyses, and pretty much all the journalists, are on the left. They're almost all globalists. And so not surprisingly, they focus all their efforts on understanding those stupid racist nationalists, and they never look at themselves and how their side does some pretty crazy and irrational things too. The other reason why it's crucial to focus on the globalists is that if you look at the long history of left and right, the only way to understand conservatism in any era and country is as a reaction to the excesses of the left. So French conservatism in the 1790s, you know, was very different from American conservatism in the 1980s, but it's always a reaction to what is seen as the left sort of pushing for too much change too fast. And so now the left, the globalist left in all of our countries, is very enamored with they're very focused on issues of race, identity, feminism, immigration. They turn those into titanic moral struggles where anyone who's against them is a racist or homophobe or some other thing. So the right-wing reaction in all of our countries is in part a reaction to the excesses of the globalists.
Well, I think you also go on to say that the globalists have a lot of comfort in the global agenda, as it were. They actually feel very comfortable with it, and they think that, in fact, it represents sort of moral progress. And there'll be people listening to say, yes, well, of course I feel positive about that, and I hate hearing some of the what I consider the throwback. And it's also a class issue. You say a lot of these people who do feel comfortable with this broader agenda, actually they do sort of travel around or read the sort of things that make them feel comfortable in this broader agenda, and that's not available. Well, but I want to test you on this. Is it not available to the nationalists or the localists, or they choose not to accept it?
Oh, no. I mean, you know, everything's available to everybody nowadays and on the internet. It's not that information is not available. I think you have to see human nature as fundamentally tribal. We're very good at forming teams and then competing with other teams, and those teams draw out our moral sentiments and our commitments. And so the nationalist team tends to be more focused on family, and conservatives give more money to charity, things like that. They tend to have more social capital, and the globalists are experts in compassion, in human rights. They tend to drive the rights revolutions, which are wonderful things. So don't get me wrong. I mean, I vote for the Democrats here in the United States. I'm not a conservative, but you have to see them as having different priorities, and then you have to put on your glasses that let you see our tribalism and see that both sides kind of go insane because of the battle. Both sides distort the motives of the other side. Both sides are susceptible to fake news. And we just can't understand each other.
Well, we've got a debate happening here in Australia about our Prime Minister announcing that there'd be effectively a judgment about Australian values for people who wanted to become citizens and want to migrate here. And the British also got themselves in a complete twiddle about this a few years back. And I've always found it very interesting, because for some people it's utterly offensive that we would try to distill this, and for others they seem to find it consoling. I mean, does that surprise you that little debate is underway? It's quite hot debate.
Oh, no,
actually.
No. That's what's so amazing to me is, you know, I just read an in-depth article about what's going on in France and the supporters of Le Pen, and it is almost identical to the kind of coming apart that's happening in the United States. The things that are affecting us, you know, it'll be a slightly different story in each of our countries, and the immigration you have in Australia is different from what we have in the United States, but it is a lot of the same sorts of things. And I think the main piece of advice that I would have for the globalists in all countries is recognize that having a sense of shared national identity, a sense of who we are, is a kind of a firm platform on which people can then be generous and welcoming. And if you don't have that sense, then many people will get this is the point of my article, many people become afraid, and it activates an authoritarian impulse. I'm drawing actually on the work of a great political scientist that you have in Australia, Karen Stenner. She has a wonderful book called The Authoritarian Dynamic. And she's very much on the left, but her advice over and over again is the left needs to stop doing these things that activate the authoritarian impulse in a subset of the right, not most people on the right, but a subset of the right that does become really racist and narrow-minded when they are threatened, when they feel that the moral order is coming apart, when they feel what she calls a normative threat. And so if you can calm that, if you can calm the normative threat, then you don't need to do these superficial, silly things like that national identity test. That's a kind of a Band-Aid. But it's better to focus on the deep problems and reassure people that, yes, we welcome immigration and we want them to assimilate. We think Australian identity is a pretty good thing. Doesn't mean it's better than everyone else, but it's ours and we love it and we cherish it. And we welcome immigrants, but we do want them to join us and become Australian.
So it's something to do with a sense of whether people feel embedded in their particular communities. And if those communities, however they define them, feel under threat for what they represent, this can lead, you're suggesting, to an illiberal response.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Now, so keep your eye, there's a very important variable called social capital. There's another term from the great sociologist Emile Durkheim called anomie, or normlessness. And, you know, no matter what your political party, you should recognize that you want your communities and your nation to have very high social capital, which means trust. You can't have a democracy if people don't trust each other and their institutions. And this is why I'm so worried about my country, because we've had declining trust in each other and institutions for decades, and in the last 6 months, it has plummeted. So I don't know what happens to us in the future. I don't know how we come back from this. And I hope that Australia and New Zealand and other countries and Canada, other countries where I think the democracy is healthier than the United States, I hope they don't go down our route.
Well, look, I mean, I'll let you go after this question, but I suppose it must be something to do with then how we deal with it, with each other. And, you know, for years we've been told, for instance, do not let a racist joke just go by, or something that is really offensive to someone else's rights. Stand up, say something. Now, I'm hearing you in a way say, well, be careful how you say something. If somebody horrifies you with what they say.
That's right. So here's how the best way you can avoid going down the American road. So, America has been divided. So the left since the 60s has focused on identity politics, on fighting racism and sexism and homophobia, and those are all good things to fight. But here's the problem. If you have diversity, as we do in America and as you do in Australia, if you have diversity, you're going to have frequent or constant misunderstandings. You're going to have conflicts. You're going to have people say things that are often accidental, and sometimes maybe they're not. And either you can have a country based on a sense of give each other some slack. You can stand up and say something, but say, you know, like, well, I know you didn't mean anything by that, but, you know, that might bother some people. You can be nice about it, or you can be vindictive and jump down people's throats. And the American model has been be as vindictive as possible, jump down their throats, accuse people of racism, sexism, and homophobia at every possible opportunity. And that's what the left has been doing, especially on campus. And guess what? When people get called a racist for perfectly innocent things, for things that they didn't mean anything by, after 5 or 10 times, they start voting for Trump. And so this is the problem. This people have pointed this out in Europe. There's a wonderful rant from Jonathan Pye you can find on the internet. If the left takes it as a kind of a quasi-religious mission to fight racism and accuse everybody of racism, people are going to hate them.
Thought-provoking. Jonathan Haidt, thank you very much indeed. And I do hope you don't become too pessimistic about the developments in your country. You never know. All this engagement might be for the good.
No, that's right. Look, you can't predict the future. And I don't have confidence that my country is going down the tubes. It's just that the direction right now is not very good.
Okay, Jonathan, I hope we can speak again. Thank you.
I hope we're still here. Bye-bye.
Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, by the way, who wrote this piece in The American Interest, if you care to check it out. He did it, actually, published it July last year, but he was very much ahead of the curve, where when and why nationalism beats globalism. And I think you'll find it very interesting, whether or not you agree, but I would be very keen to hear your thoughts, because I think there were some challenges there. And I did read some research, and I just forgot to mention it to him there, that countries that have national broadcasting systems are less likely to be polarised. Now, I'll find out where I read that, but I know I did.